Hello, world. Welcome back to your favorite historical podcast, giving you both feminism and wildly controversial opinions. I am your host, Mary Jane, and I am so glad to welcome you back to another episode of Her Story. This time, going back to a civilization most of you are probably very familiar with, but may not have experienced learning about how women affected this ancient and infamous civilization. If the American education system has taught me anything, which who's to say at this point, is that not only is the mitochondria the powerhouse of the cell, but by the age of 10, one out of every three kids has at least a brief obsession with ancient Egypt. We all learned about King Tut sometime around second grade, and maybe you were like me and first stumbled on this ancient civilization in a magic treehouse book, or the National Geographic magazines at the orthodontist office. Most of what we learn about ancient Egypt is about pharaohs like Ramses II, or footnotes on the guys who built the pyramid. Hopefully you learned a little bit about Cleopatra, and not that she was a wild snake-wielding seductress, but hey, we have a whole episode on that. More on that later. It's a fascinating topic, because ancient Egypt is one of the most longest continual civilizations in history, ruled by pharaohs and changing dynasties for thousands of years. Evidence of civilization in the Nile Valley actually dates back 5,000 years. And don't worry, I will not be attempting to contain 5,000 years of history in one episode, but hopefully it shows you that there's a lot to explore here. Real quick before jumping in, fun little anecdote. Every once in a while, I like to refresh on the internet to see if like there's any new topics or biographies coming out. So I Googled just famous women, women who changed history. That was my, I sent that off into the Google abyss. And the most incredible woman of all time, according to three articles that were shot back at me, listed Margaret Thatcher as the hero to end all heroes, Margaret Thatcher, who is no doubt famous. I'd lean more towards infamous. But given that this was the best the internet had to offer, I went back to the books. And you should already be thanking me because I read an entire book in one night in order to give you the best of the best. I've been teasing an episode on ancient Egyptian queens and female society since maybe, definitely last season, maybe two seasons now. So come on, I have to do something to keep you people on the hook. And now that time is finally here. So strap in, kids, let's roll. What's really interesting about learning about ancient Egypt is that we, in some cases, don't know a lot about people's daily lives. What we do know comes from the factors of archaeology and ancient culture that did lead to an absence of personal information for a lot of these people. The surviving texts we have of legal documents and poetry, architecture and art can inform a lot of what we know, especially for noble women. If you've ever seen Kunk on Earth, which 10 out of 10 recommend, a fantastic satirical comedy? Informative? I don't know exactly what it is, but it's fun. Go on Netflix if you have it. Kunk on Earth. Actually, I'm mad at Netflix right now. They locked me out of my account, but I don't know. They go a little fraud happy. It's like my FBI agent, so we're having a talk about that. Netflix. Call me. But yeah, whatever the host's name is, she's great. I don't know, but she has this bit where she says, "The Egyptians believed the most significant thing you can do in your life was die." And while I'm pretty sure she meant that ironically, the archaeological evidence existing for funeral practices certainly lends itself to the idea. Certainly, powerful women were buried with treasures and records of their lives and relationships. But this has often caused us to work backwards in our understanding of ancient Egypt. We focus on death and try to make connections to the living, but most historical accounts rarely go into depth about gender roles and the daily influence of religion in society. You know, beyond having your heart weighed with a feather and traveling into the afterlife, which is cool. I love reading modern takes on that, but there's so much more to explore. And yeah, at first glance, learning about women of ancient Egypt and how their society and social standing functioned sounds a lot less exciting than tracking down gold sarcophaguses and tomb raiders. But behind this period of reverence or romanticization we seem to have today for ancient Egypt is a fascinating account of the social constructs and the legal rights that, in many ways, are more progressive than modern America. Art historian Gay Robbins opens her book, Women in Ancient Egypt, with the question of why we should focus on ancient Egyptian female society in particular. Egyptology has enjoyed a lot of popularity as a discipline, from the History Channel and National Geographic, all the way to the Victorian period, where British people got really into stealing Egyptian mummies and raiding tombs and throwing the corpses in for cosmetics and medicine. And yeah, based on that fact alone, it's unsurprising that archaeology as a means of preservation and scientific study has only emerged recently. Overlooked texts and artifacts can piece together a limited understanding of what society was like, from surviving structures, mainly like temples and tombs, which were built far from populated cities in the deserts, meaning that they were more untouched by modern development or even changing political regimes. The surviving texts we do have often focus on economic and legal documents, but the concept of a diary and writing one's daily experiences and feelings wasn't really a thing. And one obvious explanation of that is that a very limited portion of the population, around 1%, were literate. So, again, opens up the question, was there a lack of writing about personal feelings and experiences because that wasn't really a cultural norm? Or was it because most of the country didn't know how to read? Take your pick. And because we do have so many limited resources, for a long time, we didn't have an understanding about what standards women lived their lives by. Leaning into this is also the prejudice of historians who first recorded and commented on all of this. They brought in their own ideals of a model woman, a wife absent from public life and subservient to her husband, emerging from male historians' own ideas on the appropriate feminine qualities. They tended to ignore evidence of women participating in society. Like, here's one example. Scholars, when writing about these women of ancient Egypt, often focus on beauty, especially dresses, makeup, jewels, and yeah, we do have a really good record of cosmetics, face creams, and even surviving jewelry to kind of lean into this. But historically, both Egyptian men and women wore makeup and jewelry. But scholars choose to usually omit this fact because it suggested an unhealthy interest in femininity for men, which is ridiculous, but what else is new? And when it comes to the expectations and standards of men, no one was above it all and set the expectations more than the pharaoh. The pharaoh was the state of Egypt. As king, he occupied a divine role that stood between the world of mortals and gods, and is reflected in the iconography from tombs and temples that survive today. Kings are often depicted with qualities resembling a god, and are seen in art ruling over their kingdom with their wives or wife, often at their side, or at least included in some part of the picture, either sitting next to them or on a throne, hell yeah, or behind, whatever. But yeah, usually you see a holy-looking pharaoh and his wife or wives depicted beside him, which is very interesting. It shows that there was an importance in royal women. Royal women were defined by their relationship to the pharaoh, but that opens up a really interesting question. If a king was divine, does that mean his female relatives or partners were also divine? And there is evidence that suggests, yes, a queen may have been seen as a living goddess. And this comes back to cultural expectations and norms set by religion. So many depictions of queen include something called the vulture headdress, which you've seen a million times if you've ever been to a museum or opened a magazine or anything. It's pretty stunning. It's like an eagle headdress and like the golden feathers coming down the side. It's iconic. And this headdress dates back to the Old Kingdom and was passed down from one queen to another. The crown was originally worn by the vulture goddess Nekhbet, protector of Upper Egypt, and the snake goddess of Lower Egypt adapted her crown to be identical, except it had a snake at the head instead of a vulture. And eventually, this headdress, or some combined version of it, was seen in other Egyptian goddesses. Scholars believe that the role of queen was a divine symbolic role, considering queens passed down royal headdresses directly linked to female goddesses. And women could, in fact, be heads of state, as seen in the life of Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut inherited the throne from her father, eventually transitioning from regent to her stepson to ruling as pharaoh in her own right from 1479 to 1458 BCE. Hatshepsut, the first female pharaoh, is regarded as one of the greatest rulers in Egyptian history, ushering in a golden age through international trade, monument and infrastructure building, and depicting herself in royal male attire and female attire under the title Daughter of Re. Unfortunately, much of Hatshepsut's contributions were lost to history. After her death, her stepson destroyed her statues and monuments, nearly wiping her from the historical record. While many queen mothers and prominent wives never achieved the power and status of the pharaoh, they played an important role in continuing the bloodline, performing ritual functions, and were incredibly influential. And again, dates back to religion. One prominent creation myth rooted in Heliopolis states that a creator god produced two deities from his own person, the male Shu and the female Tefnut, who went on to produce more gods and, in turn, created the world. Divine creation had both male and female attributes, represented in the pharaoh and his queen. Reinforcing this idea is the 2nd century CE record of how the gods Osiris and Isis created time, with Isis gifting men and women equal standing, beginning a female status that has surpassed much of the ancient world and into the early modern period. Another thing historians tend to really want to focus on is that a pharaoh famously had many wives, sometimes selected from influential nobility, educated concubines, foreign princesses, and most distastefully, their own sisters and daughters. Yeah. During seasons 1 and 2 of this show, I played a little game where we'd take a metaphorical shot every time there was incest, and I've been enjoying the fact that for a while now we've been rolling incest free. I've been over the moon about that fact. Pretty understandable. Modern historians find this very distasteful and often omit the fact that daughters were elevated to the rank of wives. We could spend the rest of this episode mulling over just how gross that is. Same with the sister thing, obviously, not skimming over that. And we could ignore that fact, like a lot of male historians have chosen to do. However, it's more useful to ask, why did this happen? In ancient Egypt, the royal bloodline was considered sacred, as the pharaoh was descended from the gods and acted as their representative on earth. For the same reason European royalty reenacted Sweet Home Alabama, ancient Egyptian royalty intermarried like the Habsburgs, with very similar genetic effects following as consequence. Also reinforcing the fact that despite how distasteful these things were, queens had insane status that was also linked to the divine, is that queens often mirrored themselves after goddesses in dress and ceremony, for example, and the role of the royal mother-daughter-wife trifecta can actually be traced back to the goddess Hathor's relationship to Ra. And being a wife was a pretty good deal if you were married to the pharaoh. Often they were gifted with their own estates and had administrators to run them. This can also be seen in the infamous harems, households of wives and concubines located in different cities, where household hierarchies between different wives were very rigid, and yet royal children were often raised here, suggesting a degree of social and certainly economic independence within the harem. Again, most male scholars choose to focus on the more sexual nature of the harem, but they were well-established royal courts in their own way that were responsible for raising royal children, running their own affairs, and created very influential structures for women to advise one another and to kind of have this weird quasi-marriage sisterhood bond. Again, Egyptian marriage, not our modern understanding of it, so there you go. Or maybe it is, you know, minus the incest. We'll see. We'll get there. One important factor is that the pharaoh was allowed to have as many lovers as he wanted, so long as he treated his queen well. Slay. And for most Egyptians, though, marriage was actually monogamous and for life, although divorce was legal and not stigmatized. A couple's separation was often seen as unfortunate, but not immoral. More often than not, queens, however, were important political players. For example, King Ahmos was the founder of the 18th dynasty, where parts of Upper and Lower Egypt had been conquered by enemy states, the Hyksos and the Nubians. He managed to drive out both occupying forces, and he probably had his mother, Ahotemp, to thank for it. Ahmos commissioned a sella, a hieroglyphic carving for recording key events and stories that included his mother's decisive political actions to preserve his reign. It reads, "One who cares for Egypt. She looked after her soldiers. She has guarded her. She has brought back her fugitives and collected together her deserters. She has pacified Upper Egypt and expelled her rebels." Because King Ahmos came to the throne relatively young, this passage suggests that the queen regent, Ahotep, was the real ruler and may have conquered and secured the state long before Ahmos reached maturity. And luckily for Ahmos, he seemed to come from a long line of queens acting as political players that dated back to his grandmother, Queen Tetashiri. Ahmos married Princess Ahmos Nefertari, the daughter of Ahotep, his sister. Again, ew. But during their reign, Ahmos elevated Ahmos Nefertari's status to God's wife of Amun, giving her and their descendants a high rank in the cult of Amun and Thebes. So not only were they important political players, but they were important religious players too, and had a control of the temple's state and influence in and how the god was worshipped. Ahmos Nefertari was part of the effort to reopen several quarries and gave approval for religious cellas and remained a revered court figure even after Ahmos died, and the throne was succeeded by one of her stepchildren. Ahmos Nefertari was deified and worshipped as patron of quarries and took the title God's Wife, something several queens, including her daughter Hatshepsut, would use. What we know about the roles of women, basically as royal wives and responsible mothers, takes an interesting turn with another surviving record: love poems. Egyptian love poems provided a very different lens at looking at all this, because instead of focusing on marriage, these odes and epics centered on the passion of young lovers. Writers focused on explicitly sexual descriptions that raised the question of whether such romantic descriptions are accurate. The big one being, was sex before marriage allowed? Another big mystery about these erotic love poems is who wrote them. A lot of these poems are written from the female lover's perspective, so does that mean they were written by women? Again, we don't know. Going back to the rights of women in marriage, you may be shocked to learn the realities of a woman's span of choices in ancient Egypt. Women had full choice of who they would marry, and matches could not be forced by male relatives or the family. Marriage was for all social classes and had no religious significance. Ceremonies didn't even take place before priests or in temples. There were social prenuptial agreements to start families and have lifelong partnerships. It did, however, include exchanges of gifts between families. The groom gave a virginity gift to compensate for a woman's deflowering upon their marriage, suggesting a cultural recognition of the importance of virginity and how it was a woman's possession to be gifted to her husband, not owed to him. For second marriages, a groom did not often offer a virginity gift, but would usually give something to the wife and her family nonetheless. And the bride's family would reciprocate and offer the groom a gift. And since households merged after the wedding, these gifts were sometimes only delivered if the couples got divorced. If the man initiated the divorce, he had to pay alimony until his ex-wife remarried or told him to buzz off. And he lost the right to sue for his gifts. Children would live with their mothers, and the house would go to the woman, assuming it wasn't owned by her husband's family before the couple wed. And what shocked me most of all was the fact that birth control was readily available to ancient Egyptian women, consisting of a recipe of acacia dates, honey, and seed wood. Don't try that at home, but yeah, this recipe still exists today, expanding our prior assumption that motherhood was the main appeal for a woman's abilities as a wife and life partner. Life for women of all social classes, though undoubtedly more restricted than their male counterparts, allowed them to still be active participants in not only society, but the economy. Women were weavers and farmers, selling at markets on the Nile. They worked as dancers and musicians for entertainment or rituals, including as professional funeral mourners. Legal rights for women included the right to represent themselves in proceedings, own property, and divorce their husband. In a separation, a woman was entitled to 1/3 of the marital assets. And she had sole control of all the property she'd had before getting married. And when it came to passing her possessions along, a woman had full say in who inherited what. An astronomical increase in legal rights compared to women of Europe and the Americas, who, up through the late 19th century, depended on the generosity of male relatives after the death or separation of a spouse, and lost their property, often falling into financial ruin unless they remarried or had a very generous father-in-law. One surviving example of this is the will of Nanakate, of the Deir el-Medina, a village of artisans during the 12th to 11th century BCE. Several papyrus papers documenting her will have been found, listing out her assets and which of her children would inherit what. She also listed the children who would inherit nothing from her because they hadn't cared for her in her old age. So true. There are modern scholars of Egyptology suggesting that women were equals of men, which is literally the most exciting new historical debate I have ever been a part of because I love it. Not saying that, like, the epitome of my life is to be equal to a man because I think, you know, it's more about people and self-value than perpetuating the white feminist idea of surpassing other women by playing into male stereotypes. But it still, again, opens up a really cool new debate. A husband ran the country and headed the household, but it was the woman who controlled the home, as well as contributed to their income and even culture as brewers, doctors, and scribes. That's right. We have the modern art of beer thanks to the women of ancient Egypt. Women also cared for the religious shrines in their homes, for families to pray outside of, festivals, or the occasional visits to temples. And many temples, especially for female goddesses, had classes of priestesses who acted as seers, dream interpreters, physicians, and teachers. After years of hard work studying to become a scribe, a woman could enter the priesthood and gain tremendous social influence, as well as control of temple property. The priesthood was not the only option for independence, though. Women could study to become doctors in Alexandria, believed to be one of the best medical centers in the ancient world. Women across Egypt and the Mediterranean came to Alexandria to study medicine, which was typically forbidden for women in their home countries. Tragically, women's rights would severely regress during the Roman occupation of Egypt, especially continuing through the empire's Christianization and the eventual Arab conquest. Season 1, Episode 1's episode of Cleopatra VII, the last independent pharaoh and one of the great pharaohs of all time, is a fantastic reference for this, along with last season's profile on Shajar al-Durr, the world's only female sultan who reigned in medieval Cairo. On top of that, definitely kind of recommend our prior episode on female archaeologists. Again, it's like when your teacher gives you suggested reading, except such suggested reading comes with my melodical voice and the occasional dig at Ronald Reagan. If you can't tell from a lot of my little dropping hints during this story, religion has a huge impact on how we structure society, modeling our values after the stories we prize. Christian Europe spread the inequality between genders based on the story of Adam and Eve. Society hinged on that belief in order to justify the seizure of property, denial of the vote and economic ownership, as well as social and marital connections. Within most patriarchal societies, I do believe that there's a level of male insecurity and fear of the effeminate. To agree, that would make Ken's Mojo Dojo Casa House from Barbie look like a women's march. And that certainly feeds into the religious zeal of putting down people different than the traditional white male European archetype. Ancient Egypt, though still a patriarchal society, had strong traditions of matrilineal inheritance and leadership. Recognizing the importance of the divine feminine in creation allowed Egyptian women to be leaders in their families, courts, academic and religious circles, and even oversee male servants and business employees. The stories we tell matter. That's a very simple, very profound statement for all this, I think. The stories we tell, the records we find, the religious texts we read, they can empower or silence us based on their perspectives and the values they impart. Were ancient Egypt's gender dynamics favoring women in a lot of cases a result of its mythology? Or were these mythological stories created to reflect what the society already valued between genders? This may not be the kind of question we can answer thousands of years later, at least not in just one episode, but the answer may lie somewhere in between. Just the existence of these values, though, reaffirmed through leadership and cultural norms, created a civilization that prospered for thousands of years, reimagining medicine, warfare, statesmanship, art, technological development, all by allowing women to participate and show off their talents. When it comes to history, everyone's always looking for a good lesson to carry on, for role models to impart to their daughters, for ways to understand how and why the world today looks the way it does. And when it comes to women expressing themselves in different spheres of politics and social life, and especially in education and in stories, the women of ancient Egypt, the queens, the mothers, the scholars, the priestesses, the farmers, the weavers, the goddesses, they seem like a good place to start, because the more we learn about them, the more we realize that they have thousands of years of stories left to tell us. This was just a brief dive into how social standings and religion affected ancient society, and even today continue to affect our society. Ancient Egypt is only one example of this, but damn, is it not exciting to know that up till thousands of years ago, women were still actively participating in everything and weren't shamed for it. It's a relief, you know? It feels good. it's good to remember that things aren't always bleak, you know? It's a good place to start. Assuming you haven't read all, you haven't kept up on all these past Her Story episodes, I think you have some homework to do. So, hopefully you'll jump back and catch up on your favorite past episodes. So, before all that, I just want to thank you so much for joining me. I, if you can't tell, had a great time talking about just how cool it is that we can have intelligent conversations about worlds where thousands of years and oceans separated by. It's pretty epic, so thank you so much for joining me, and I will see you next week for another woman who made her story.